I want to finish up the discussion of differences between men and animals, the question of what are the distinctively human kinds of behavior. And to sum it up, I want to show a couple slides, then I would like to engage the panel in some discussion, or all of you, whoever will get into this, if the panel is here. I think we mentioned this slide. We were talking about it when the last time I talked to you. But I want to remind you of it and to get us sort of focused on what it is we're talking about. If you look at each one of these words and let your imagination run with it a bit, you will, I think, appreciate that each one of them does sum up a very important difference between the human being and animals. I don't want to labor these now. I just want to remind you of them and go on to the next slide. And then we will have some discussion, I hope. In order to bring this to a sharper focus, I would like to point to the significance of the way we handle the differences and the similarities among our perceptions as we abstract. The most effective abstracting, the most effective thinking, the most creative, constructive kind of thinking, most effective of the relations we make to our environment and to each other, involve, it seems to me, a balance of an optimal sort between the emphasis upon how things are the same and how things are different. There are always similarities, there are always differences. And in general, we recognize and we understand, we identify anything that we deal with by differentiating it from other things or by classifying it with other things. And I think that a feeling for the abstracting process is at bottom a feeling for this balance between the emphasis we give to how things are the same and the emphasis we give to how things are different. I think that there needs to be, I am using the word needs here in a way which implies a personal preference, I think, which you should be on guard against. I think there needs to be correspondingly more emphasis given to differences by most of us, because our language, by virtue of the fact that there are fewer words than there are things to talk about, so that we must use each word to refer to many different things, and this tends to imply that these things are the same because we give them the same name. Because of this influence of the language we use, and because perhaps somehow related to this, we develop attitudes, we develop customs, we develop traditions which are consistent with this. We tend to overemphasize greatly, I think, the similarities among people, among situations, among days, times, so that among the very most common of the common sayings are that You can't change human nature, and people are pretty much the same the world over, and no matter how thin you slice it, it's still baloney. We tend to have a feeling, prejudice, that the common sense, good judgment, wisdom consists very much in seeing similarities. And many of the tests that we give, what we call intelligence tests, are this pattern. For instance, analogies tests. How are things the same? How are things alike? I think if you want to achieve what is likely to be an optimal sort of balance between noting of differences and the noting of similarities, you would need to do more noting of differences in almost all situations which you have to deal with. Now, with that kind of an introduction, let's talk about something. I get the feeling here sometimes that I lecture too much, that I do too much of the talking, and I feel that I have not succeeded very well in handling the panel, orchestrating the panel this year. I don't want to waste our time wondering why, but I would like very much to hear you, and it isn't that I want to be selfish and just enjoy myself listening to you. I think that we would perhaps use our time better if you were to engage yourselves with some rather fundamental questions. For example, as I believe Tom Schreiner reminded you, a human being is able to act like an animal, is able to copy the behavior of an animal. But an animal can't very well copy the behavior of a human being. Not so completely. Now, ask yourself, what is there about your dog that you could copy? How can you behave like a pigeon? What would you do in order to behave like a pigeon? How would you copy a pigeon? How would you copy a horse? How would you really act as though you had horse sense that would be different from the way you would act as though you had man sense? If you wanted to bring up your child in a way that would make him most fully human, most different from his pets, what would you have him not do that his pets do? What would you try to have him cultivate that his dog or his kitten or his little pet duck or hamster probably could never hope to copy? What are these differences in the terms of everyday living? Is the panel here? Is Lucy Klosterman, Tom Neal, Sandra Keller, Donna Krusik, George Leifer, Doug Leslie? Are they here, or did the cold get them? And if not, we'll go on without the panel. And let's just have some talk. What do you observe, then, to put it another way, people doing that looks most animalistic to you? Sort of a signal reaction type of thing? Can you remember an instance? Can you talk about somebody at some time, at some place, doing something? You're still talking about everybody and they. Can you talk about somebody at some hour, at some place, doing something? You're probably bothered by now, and maybe you'd like a minute or two to collect your wits without having everybody waiting for you. So why don't you take a minute, and someone else, I'll come back to you.
Well, to some extent, I think that animals more wait for things to happen to them than people do.
Animals wait for things to happen to them more than people do. You're thinking about the complacent cow, are you? And you're thinking about the worrying person. Huh? Did you read Earl Wilson's column this morning about the optimist? Optimist is a man who lies awake all night telling himself how lucky he is that he doesn't have insomnia. That's not animalistic, I suppose. What would be most valuable would be to, and you might not want to do this in public, you might, I don't know, is to talk about yourself. What are your most animalistic kinds of behavior? In this deafening chorus of voices, maybe you can be heard. That's a rather good example. What ways do you conform, and to whom? Remember the New Yorker cartoon, the bedraggled long-haired housewife who was looking at her husband and his old dirty tennis shoes and the rest of it, and she's saying to him, "Why do you have to be a nonconformist like everybody else?" To whom are you conforming? Well, I don't mean that you have to answer out loud unless you want to. You thought of any more signal reactions?
What she had picked up at the bus stop.
example. Rather tragic one. Someone had a hand up there.
I was going to ask, in the comment on conformity, in relation to your asking for animalistic behavior, I don't quite see the relationship between conformity and animalistic behavior, in that people can and do do what manipulate the behavior, the dress, etc., to conform. If you fall into some sort of a pattern, we would say, where animals are, I would say, incapable of any sort of manipulation. They conform, you know, it's their nature, and they don't have the ability to not conform.
There's a hand.
What's the relationship between
I'm not trying to evade the answer, but here's a hand. Let's see if this will contribute to it.
Well, I was going to say one of the things animals, some kind of animals, can change their types of conformity. There are strays and herds.
Yeah. They're strays. They. What is a stray like on the human level? What's the human counterpart of a stray calf? A lost little boy? Or is it something more than that? No, I think that's a nice example. You ought to put it in blank verse. You got something. It's nice. It's nice.
On the other hand, is there a mental process involved here that is not analytical? A mental process that demands, that needs this good feeling, that is not signal.
So we're talking about group feeling, aren't we? We're not talking about group feeling, we're talking about conformity. We're talking about a perceived group feeling. We're not talking about the fact that man can be called gregarious. We're talking about a passion of self or a
making some kind of a distinction between perception and what you mean by signal reaction? Are you assuming that the signal reaction involves no perception?
Perception as a differentiator. Well, what I mean by perception is the process that goes on in the mind between the stimulus and the response. Now, the way you describe the situation, the analogy between the puppy and the action of the individual to some group comfort that he seems to be getting, it seems to me, was did not involve a mental process that had gone on demanding the solace or the comfort, which seems to me differentiates it from a signal reaction.
Well, first of all, I think the puppy in the head with a pipe.
You didn't?
I did not.
No.
I did not hit the puppy in the head with a pipe. Now, the puppy, I believe, reacted as though I had touched him with my hand rather than hitting him with a pipe.
Oh, I see.
So this denotes an evaluative process. Now, I would be willing to raise a grant here. It may have been more synapses or something in a human who identifies with the group. The dog
who values
the hand. There are a great number of
them. We're seeming to say some things here that might be pointing up an issue. You might have been implying that a mental process would not be animalistic.
I didn't wish to say that.
I wish I knew your names and I could talk to you better. What did you say, Charles?
Jerome.
Yeah, Jerome. since we would have to be at some pains to define mental process before we could say that a puppy might exhibit one, I think the kind of differentiation that... Harless was talking about is a little closer to what we could observe. That is, you've seen, you can talk about how animals react differently as we observe them reacting to different kinds of responses on our part or different kinds of stimuli or situations. Whether they have mental processes, this is something else that I would find rather difficult to come to any conclusion.
Our whole discussion of the difference between animal, which we call animal reaction, and human, which we would call symbol reaction, is a difference between some synaptic process that's going on in the mind, in the gray matter.
When you say mind, you mean brain, don't you?
In the brain, yes. In the brain, that differentiates the animal from the human being along some continuum of synaptic reactions in the mind and the brain.
To me, the difference is essentially one of the variability of response or conditionality of it, the relative consistency under varying conditions. And the signal reaction, whether made by a human being or dog, and it couldn't be by either. The term signal reaction is a rather gross categorical term for the low end of a continuum where there is not very much variation in the responses. That is, this is a reaction of the prejudiced individual, for example, to whom all hooligarians are, that's all he needs to know, it's hooligarian. There is no variation in the response. He hates them all. And this is something like the reaction of a pigeon who makes no differentiation in the blue lights, he pecks them all. The term symbol reaction is a name, a rather gross categorical name, for another end of the continuum, the other end of the continuum, where there is considerable variation of response depending upon what goes with the cue. And I don't know, they both involve, I'd be willing to settle for the statement, they both involve mental processes.
What I was trying to say last time is that when we find an individual or group of individuals who not only desire but need the comfort of the group, and wearing thin shoes, as everyone wears thin shoes, or wearing boots, whatever, it may not necessarily be a signal of reaction, but maybe something that is purely part of the personality.
That's true. That's true, and I would be.
And these experiences, in which you act prior experiences, and how they condition his reaction now, I think are differentiating things between him.
That's right.
And some signal of reaction now.
And I would be making a signal reaction if I were to say that all conformists were alike or all nonconformists were alike, and it really is very difficult to talk with these terms. It seems to me that whenever we talk about nonconformists, we're talking about people who conform to some standard, which by some other standard makes them nonconformist. But they are just as much conformist, perhaps, as those who are conforming to some other set of standards.
I didn't have in mind the kind of conformity that is dependent only upon socks or sweaters or shoes.
Uniform.
I'm thinking more of the kind of in-group behavior. This clannishness of belief that, as I understand, sociologists use the term often to, a tensor thing that.
They say outer directed and inner directed. To use Reisman's. You're talking about the outer directed person.
Yes, more of that sort of thing.
Well, I have no doubt we're leaving an awful lot of loose ends lying around. But suppose you carried on in your own bull sessions, and let's see what we can do the rest of the time. To try to keep up with what we have announced we're going to do, I would like to go on and talk about something that has come to be talked about in recent years as language models. I think the basic consideration is that language, no matter how you consider it, language in any form is a substitute. It's a substitute for something else. If you talk about it in terms of the process of abstracting, the verbal abstracts are substitutes for nonverbal abstracts. They stand for them, we say. We say that a word means something else. It stands for something else. Or a word represents something else. But it's always a substitute. Now, what kind of a substitute can language be? Well, when you begin to answer this question, then you begin to get into the matter of models. There are various kinds of models. Language can serve the function of various kinds of models. But I think it is pretty important to do some considering, first of all, of what any model is supposed to do. And it is a substitute for, or it is a form for representing what we call reality or beings, what might be, but what we suppose actually is. And this, of course, is, shall we say, very philosophical. In one sense, we know very well what there is. This is. Well, what's this? Well, it's a sensation, isn't it? And it's another sensation, isn't it? And it's another sensation. So there are observings. And a model somehow represents observings. A model may represent something we call feelings, and this word has ambiguity to a high degree. We use the word in such a varied way. I had a most interesting discussion the other day with Professor Oppenheimer, who is head of the Russian department, who was pointing out that in Russian and in other languages, but he was talking at the moment about Russian, a word like transportation, for example, or administration, I think one of the reasons we have difficulty communicating with the Russians, he thought, was to be found in this difference in the language. Our word administration is a very ambiguous word, and we use it in many ways. They have a different word for example, administration. We talk about the administration, and we mean the persons. The administration of the university consists of the president and the deans, and we use the same word to talk about that, to name that, as we do to name what they do. The administration of the university, meaning the acts that are carried out, the policies that are formulated, and the procedures that are carried out in terms of those policies. That's administration. The Russians have a different word for that. They have different names for those two things. They would never refer to the persons with the same word that they use to refer to what they do. And he said this is a characteristic of the Russian language, that they have many more words than we do. And this is one of the reasons why it is rather difficult to learn Russian. It taxes your memory very greatly because you have to learn many more words. We make one word do a very great variety of chores. If you ever stop to consider a word like get and how many different kinds of uses we make of it. We get sick, we get rich, you can easily rattle off 25 or 50 very different ways of using get. Most of our words are this way. Now, the we have to be, I think, if we are going to understand some of the troubles we have communicating with each other and with other peoples, other cultures, we need to be aware of this possible difference in ambiguity. You notice it in talking to the persons around you, all of whom are speaking the same language. They're speaking English. But you will find it much more baffling to talk to some persons than others, because some persons are a little like the Russians. They want you to use a different word when you're saying a different thing. They don't react well to flexibility of usage. I know psychologists, for example, who insist that you not use the words anxiety and fear as though they were interchangeable. Well, you get very many of these little verbal specificities in your habit system, you're rather hard to communicate with. The distinctive thing about our language, about English as we speak it, I think, is that we depend so heavily upon the context supplying the cues to what we mean. And so you have to listen very, very carefully to an American talking English. What he means depends upon what else he's saying. Whereas in other languages, this might not be so true. There's a word for it each time. And more is made of case endings and the neuter, the feminine versus the masculine forms, etc., etc. Well, what got me off on this was when we get to talking about things like this, you run into words like feelings. And we use this word feeling in such a variety of ways. And you always have to listen to the context to know what the person is talking about. So I want to let you know that I know that when I use words like this, it's pretty difficult to indicate what I'm trying to mean by them on a list like this. But there are distinctions we make. And if we listen closely to each other, we recognize that we tend to be referring to different things with these words. And for all of what we mean by these words, our language is a substitute. We can mean something with all of these words that is on the nonverbal levels of abstraction. Imaginings are on this lowest level that we talked about. And there is a sense in which we can say that what we imagine we abstract from what might really be. But this gets very difficult to manage, to talk about. Now let's have the next slide and talk about some of the models that we have, some of the ways in which we try to fashion language as though we were talking about whatever we were talking about, as though it were an animism or a mechanism or a statistical population or something else. We're always talking about X as though it were like Y. We talk about, we hardly ever make a direct statement that is specifically about what we seem to be talking about. You almost always have to use words which seem to imply comparisons that you're making. We've talked a good deal in the course about animistic language and about mechanistic language, talking about the world around us, about clouds and wind and water and the trees and the universe, as though it were somehow animistic, as though these things were like us, as though the weather had desires. And as the rivers wanted to go down to the sea, when we talk about nature as though it were somehow motivated by what we seem to talk about as though they were animistic spirits. We talked about the mechanistic kinds of models, the clock language of Descartes, and the language of the telephone. We're talking about the nervous system. We talk about the nervous system of the human being as though it were a telephone system. Some of these other models, if you have read the book by Goffman that is on the list, can't seem to remember the name of that thing. It's the presentation of the self in everyday life. He uses a model of the theater to talk about the self, about the way one presents oneself to others. And he uses a model of the theater and talks about what you do in the front stage and backstage. And the interesting developments which occur when the backstage becomes the front stage, and when you admit another person to the backstage area of your life or of your group's activities. Did you happen to see the television documentary about a month ago of the events leading up to the admission of the Negroes to the University of Alabama? Did you happen to see this? This was a very dramatic example of converting the backstage into front stage. I am not sure how they did some of this. They must have had the movie cameras going all the time when these events were taking place, because on the television presentation we saw, for example, Robert Kennedy talking to Katzenbach, his deputy, who was down in Alabama, and they were indulging in what would definitely be called backstage talk that you don't normally have going on the front stage. While just what Katzenbach was supposed to do with Governor Wallace, and why do it this way, the impression this would make, etc. And it was all the kind of thing you do off by yourself in the hotel room, but you never tell anybody as a rule. Those are the thoughts you have. Well, this is a kind of pattern of behavior that can be talked about very well in Goffman's model of the theater. And of course Shakespeare said that all the world's a stage, you see, and so forth. Now, this is a good example of a model. There's no limit to the models that you can create or that you can adapt to your purposes. I showed you a model that I made of, we can talk about ourselves observing as though we were a camera developer and a projector. as a model. And with this model, you can highlight certain aspects of this behavior that otherwise are rather difficult to talk about. I was taught when I went to school to be very leery of analogies, that you shouldn't use analogies, some of my teachers said, as I remembered. And, of course, if you study language enough, you will have to conclude that you can only talk in analogies. But you can talk with an awareness that you are doing this. You can use models knowingly, or you can use them without a consciousness of abstracting in this specific sense. You can use models without an awareness that you are using models. You can talk about the human being as though he were a clock and not know that he isn't a clock. You can talk about the weather as though it had a mind of its own and not know that you are doing this in an artificial way, a contrived way. You may think the weather really does have a mind of its own. It's very difficult to use language at all without talking about whatever you're talking about as though it were something else. And the difference between the person who does this adroitly and effectively and the one who does it in sort of a stumble-bum fashion is to be found in the degree to which the speaker is aware of his analogy and how well, if he's aware of it enough, he adapts it well. And he's aware of the limitations of it, and he makes the listener aware of the limitations of it. There are an awful lot of books these days written about the so-called thinking machines. And this is as good an example as any I know of the need to be aware of the model as a model. There are no thinking machines. But you can talk about computers as though they were thinking. But the limitations of the model are enormous. And you can turn around and talk about a human being as though he were a thinking machine, which you've already mislabeled, and now you get into very great difficulty. There is the difference between a human brain and a computer, any computer so far designed, is, I think, far more significant than any similarities. There are some interesting similarities, certainly, which can be talked about very profitably, so long as we are highly aware that we're talking in terms of model language, and a model language with very drastic limitations. Now, I think where this comes alive in some of its most important respects is when we talk about human beings as though they were animals, as though we talk about the learning of a human child as though it were the same as the learning of a rat, or the learning of a pigeon. Yeah, the similarities are very intriguing and very instructive and valuable. We get some good leads from them. But the limitations are, I think, very important. Thank you for looking at your watch. Maybe look at mine. We're over time.
Things that the stutter does as a result of tremendous learning. The marvel would appear to be, from a learning point of view, that he could ever undo this. He's learned it so well. Compared to stopping smoking, that would be peanuts compared to stopping stuttering. Try to think of other things that you do, habits you'd like to break. And it would be fortunate if you've got one that you have been trying for years to break without success. Now you'll begin to get some empathy for the stutter. Well, now what the noise does is this. He talks and you tell him while he can still hear you, before he does this, concentrate on how it feels. What you're doing, you see, is that you are blocking out the auditory feedback, and so now he can concentrate on the kinesthetic feedback. And now it becomes very vivid, the kinesthetic feedback. And there isn't any, practically. And he learns in this very direct way that it takes no effort to talk. He can hardly feel it. In fact, he can really almost get confused as to what he's saying. There's almost no kinesthetic feedback. There's almost no strain, no effort, no tensing. And there is, I think, probably no better way for him to learn that the tensing is the problem. Tensing is what is wrong here. Tensing is what he must not do if he's going to talk normally, as he does in the noise. And the way it feels is almost utterly devoid of any tension at all. Well, once he learns enough of this, he begins to be able to act on it. He shouldn't tense. Now this is going to bother you if you don't change your frame of reference. This word avoidance reaction is a very key term in the frame of reference in which we talk about controlling the stuttering. We say, go ahead and stutter. Don't avoid it. That's what you say when you are trying to modify the stuttering. But when you isolate this tensing as something which is an interfering behavior, you want to avoid it. Talk without tensing. But it's very difficult for a stutterer to do that unless he has the necessary learning as a kind of a foundation for it. He must learn that normal speaking really is free of tensing. To him, one normally strains to talk. And he's got to learn, normally you don't. He has formed a habit, he has become accustomed, he has gotten used to, it's part of his self-image as a speaker to sort of drag his verbal heels. He's hesitant, he's cautious, he is being careful not to run head-on into difficult words. He needs to practice talking fast and loudly, because another thing, ordinarily, stutter also has tried to conceal the problem from others by not talking up too much. And then if he does stutter, it won't be too conspicuous. But if he's talking like this and stutters, it's very conspicuous. So he tends to keep his voice down and go slow. And he needs to counteract that. Go fast and loud. and get the feel of what this is like. And do this by contrast. Go in his usual hesitant, cautious way, and then speed up. And then go in the usual hesitant way, and speed up. Get the contrast. Next slide. Contrast. Contrast the stuttering and the non-stuttering. Whenever you stutter, get the feel of that, and then ideally you would say it over until you don't stutter on it, and get the feel of that. And what's the difference? Some more of this accentuating of the positive can be done by getting the stutter to empathize with normal speakers. That is, listen intently while a person talks and try to imagine yourself into his place and his performance. What would it be like to do what he's doing? Listen to a good newscaster on television, or any good speaker on television, or in real life situation, and to sit there intently trying to make yourself feel the way that speaker must be feeling. Try to imagine yourself as lively as you can, in as lively a way as you can, doing what he's doing. Get the feel of that. That's what you're trying to do. Be accepting of yourself, and I put the word accepting in quotation marks because I don't mean that you should give up and just be yourself as you are as of now. Not at all. Improve. Go ahead. Be different. But at any given moment, don't add to your problem, don't add to your tensings by rejecting what you're doing, by being ashamed of yourself, by being discouraged, by feeling inferior, by disapproving. Try to put into practice, where you are concerned, in your reactions to yourself, the same sorts of things that you tell a mother. You tell her certain things to do about her child and how to feel toward him and what attitudes to have toward him. Well, feel that way about yourself. Have those attitudes toward yourself. Be as accepting of yourself as you would want a mother to be of her child. Give yourself a chance to do your best. It's part of what I'm saying. Cultivate a normal speaking self-image. Partly I have been referring to this, but do it in other ways. Also. One way is to imagine yourself. Try to picture yourself in your mind's eye, as you might put it. You are going to make a phone call. You're going to call a girl for a date. All right. Imagine yourself. Picture yourself at the telephone. What do you see? Try to see a calm, at ease person picking up the phone, dialing, and speaking without tensing. Try to picture yourself doing that, because you will tend to act according to your self-picturings. The noon whistle blows, so I'm going to hustle on. Do more talking, okay. Talk more about the problem. This is, I wish I had time to elaborate this. You need to provide for yourself the best conditions for learning, the best conditions for modifying your behavior, for improving, for taking on this new and better kind of speaking behavior. One of the best ways to do this is to let the listener know that you are trying to do this. You don't, this takes very little communication. You don't have to gab and gab and gab about your operation. You just have to let people know that you are working on something, and it's darned interesting, and go on working. But talk more about the problem to those whom you need to talk to about. Next slide, please, Leonard. I think I can. And this, I am concerned more than I am about anything else in this situation here with you, that you are going to think, from what I have said up to now, that this is all very simple. It's just a matter of getting a hold of the right key idea and a few gimmicks and few little techniques, and anybody can do this. Now, this is, I wish it were more simple. I have nothing against simplicity. But let's be realistic. The individual is not very likely to change his behavior in the ways that I've been indicating at all, or certainly not very much. So long as he talks to himself, and he talks to himself all day long, continuously, with a language that tells him that he has something, that he is something, because he can't change what he is, he can't change what he has, and so he doesn't really try. And you tell him to do these things I've been talking about, he may do them dutifully and go through motions, but he's not learning much of anything, because he doesn't really think he can. He thinks he is a stutterer. He thinks he has blocks. Well, this is hopeless. Then he has blocks because he is a stutterer, and what can you do about this? He has tension, he says. This is a thing. That's a noun. Look out for nouns when you work in a clinic. Look out for nouns. Use verbs. You can have nouns. You have to do verbs. You can't change what you have. You can change what you do. So get the stutter talking about what he does that interferes with his speaking, not his speech, as though there were a thing here. His speaking, what you're dealing with are interfering behaviors. And you want to get rid of the interfering behavior so he can go ahead and do what is the normal behaving. Interfering behaving, I slipped up. And there's a little gimmick, I don't like to call it a gimmick, it's really quite a technique, which I describe here as hold and evaluate, the stuttering reaction. So you tell this stutter, now go ahead. As soon as you stutter, I'll tell you to hold it. And you keep doing it. And then I'm going to supply some questions. Don't answer them out loud, but you'll be answering these for yourself. Now you do this 5-10 times, and all you have to do is just have to signal. He knows what to do. He'll ask the questions. But this is what you want him to do. He's talking along and he's hold it. I can't demonstrate and talk too. But all right, this is what I was doing. Keep doing it. And ask yourself, what are you doing? What are you doing? Not what is happening to you. What are you doing? My God, I'm holding my tongue up against the back of the teeth. Well, what for? What for? He's never asked himself this before. This is a very startling question. You could not possibly have a reason for doing this. except he thinks he has to control something. He has to contend with something. But he's doing this, and that's all there is to have to be concerned about, is what he is doing. What if he were not doing that? What would be happening? He'd be talking. So what else can he do? Well, he'll be ingenious if he will let himself be, by asking himself these kinds of questions while he holds. This is, as far as I'm concerned, the basic procedure. So far as you work on the interfering behavior itself, you identify it, you become highly aware of it, you evaluate it in a functional way. What are you doing it for? What else could you be doing? What would you be doing if you didn't do it? Well, now go ahead and talk without interfering then. And then try to modify and speak without the tensing, without the interfering reactions. One more slide, I think, Leonard, and we can go to lunch. And let's put it this way, to be real brief. Ask this daughter, what would you do tomorrow if you were suddenly entirely relieved of the problem? All right, start doing it. Start living as though you were different. And you'll be different a whole lot sooner. And to do all this I've been talking about, plus all else I haven't had time to mention, you'll do better if you work with a certified clinician, certified by the American Speech and Hearing Association. And they're not all alike, so you might want to hunt a little. Thank you.